This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I wasn't surprised when writer Richard Price first teamed up with director Martin Scorsese because they both tell stories about the kind of streetwise ethnic characters they grew up with. Richard Price's 1974 novel The Wanderers was about street gangs in the Bronx where he grew up. He followed that with the novels Blood Brothers, Ladies' Man, and The Breaks. His first screenplay for Scorsese was The Color of Money. He also wrote the Scorsese segment of New York Stories. This summer, two of Price's movies, both starring Robert De Niro, will open, Mad Dog and Glory and Night in the City. Movies kept Price away from novel writing for about 8 years, but now he has an ambitious new book called Clockers about crack dealers and cops. He had written from a cop's perspective in his screenplay for Sea of Love. In Clockers, the chapters alternate between the perspectives of cops and dealers. Before we talk, Richard Price is going to read from Clockers. I'll let him set up the story.
One of the main characters in a book is this kid, Strike, who's a 19-year-old drug dealer, who's a sub-lieutenant for this other guy who's an older, more charismatic figure in the community. He's a drug dealer that has Strike and a dozen kids working for him. And his name is Rodney. And what Rodney likes to do is he likes to take five of his young drug dealers for sort of a booster club, Chamber of Commerce-type lunch, where he lectures them on having the right attitude. And the kids never really get what Rodney's saying because they're too young and too immature in their life, is, you know, too scattered and impulsive. And Strike is the only guy that Rodney's ever gotten through to, and Strike has become sort of his de facto son and his young prince. And at this point, Rodney has been lecturing the kids for about 15 minutes about bank books and prudence and everything, and the kids are all spacing out on him. And this is Strike's thoughts about what Rodney has just put forth to all the other drug dealers. Strike guessed that he was probably the only kid who had ever received Rodney's restaurant lecture and understood right away what he was saying. During that first lunch a year ago, Rodney's eyes had lit up with gratitude and pride when he saw Strike stay right with him. Finally, he'd saved one. Rodney's other clockers always went down. They were too poor, too immature, a lifetime of one way going up against 2 months of the other way. Other way didn't stand a chance. You got to start respecting yourself. Rodney was still hammering away, not ready to give up. The kid that spends it as fast as he makes it don't believe it's real, don't believe in himself. He's thinking like with a 2-minute clock, thinking like a poor man, like his life is day to day, minute to minute. He got no future because he don't think of no future. Strike watched the kids tune out, dip in fries and ketchup, one by one turning to wave down the waitress and order orange sodas or Cokes, their cognacs left unfinished. You got to believe in yourself. You got to start thinking about your future. And that means you got to start saving your damn money. Hell, they do, Rodney pointed out to the room. There ain't a person in this restaurant right now can't go home and show me a bank book. And you kids making more day by day, week by week than them all. But I'll bet come the end of the month they got more than you do. Rodney whirled his hands around each other, cocking his head. Do you all get what I'm saying? I hear that, Charles said automatically. Rodney sagged with frustration, looking like the old man of 37 he was, then said, well, the hell with it, I tried, and got back to his ribs. Strike was relieved that the lecture seemed to be over, glad that Rodney didn't do his self-image exercise, making everybody come up with a positive word that started with the same letter as their first name. Going around the table, people saying stuff like terrific Tyrone, sexy Strike, rockin' Rodney. 6 months ago, one kid had called himself Brightful Booker, and then almost put his fork in someone's chest when everybody laughed. But Rodney wasn't done. He lit up again, tried one last approach. I mean, look at Strike here. The kids did as they were told, Strike looking away as if he had seen something out at the bar. Look how my man dressed. No flash, color coordinated, nice pair of dark Reeboks, none of them paratrooper sneakers you all like to wear. Jump out a window, you bounce right back. No one laughed. I mean, check this out. The narcotics roll up on my man at a red light. What do they see? Because you know they're going to be profiling. They see a kid in a 2-year-old Accord, no gold on, nice hair, not no high-rise billboard up top his head, nice dark sweater, probably driving like my grandma. You think the narcotics going to be thinking clocker? Hell no, they thinking a 9-to-5 kid working at First Jersey or some damn thing. Strike's doing it right. Strike's getting over, cause Strike's quiet storm. Strike fumed, thinking lose the Accord. A table of strangers now knowing it's a dope car. And Strike's got himself a safe. Abruptly, Strike rose from his chair. Now they all knew he saved it, which meant he's got it. Rodney getting him killed. Strike stood over Rodney, trying to hold in his anger, keep himself stone-faced and without stammering. I got to book. I got to see my parole officer. As Strike walked from the table, he heard Rodney say, Strike's got like 4 safes. So come knock night, when the knockos come down, they can't confiscate his money. See what I'm saying? I mean, Strike's here to stay. Strike palmed his gut. Lose the safes. Lose the accord. Lose Rodney, too.
Richard Price, how did you start observing this scene?
Well, in 1986, I was going out with cops in Hudson County, New Jersey, sort of soaking up some atmosphere for Sea of Love. And I got very hooked on seeing the world through cops' eyes, because when you run with cops, you see, you know, humans in such extremists. You get, you never see life on such a life and death level, day in, day out, night times, day times. It wasn't that I was crazy about cops, but I just wanted to keep witnessing, you know, all this human struggle. And at some point, I decided that I would like to leave the cop's point of view and see the world through the eyes of those that the cops deal with, which are the world of the victims, the world of the predators, and all the people for which the cop in the neighborhood coming down very quickly is more prevalent than the mailman coming.
But how did you get connected to the dealers? It's easier to call up a precinct and ask for permission to drive
the cops
around with
cops. The cops called the dealers for me. It's, you know, in a mid-sized city, the way law and order works, it's real flexible. I mean, everybody needs everybody. A homicide investigator won't solve any crimes if he doesn't have people talking to him. And if you don't do favors for people, people won't do favors for you. And everything is relative. So, yeah, you skipped your hearing and there's a warrant out on you and a cop says, well, I'll fix it for you, but remember my name. And, the guy's going to have to remember his name. Or, the criminal's got a problem, and he'll come to the cop and say, listen, if you can get me out from under the rock, I'll give you a name on something else which is heavier, or I'll turn over the guys that I've been dealing with buying from in greater quantity. It's all little fish giving up bigger fish.
So when you first approached dealers and told them that you were writing a book and you wanted to follow them for a while, what kind of rap did you give them?
I just met him through the cops. I met him in the homicide office. There's one guy, and you know, we just talk. For people just check you out, and basically they want to see, A, if hanging out with you is going to put them in jeopardy, B, are you a jerk? I certainly wasn't going to put anybody in jeopardy for helping me out, and I guess I wasn't big enough jerk for them to say no. And, after a 3-hour conversation, the dealer in front of the cop said, well, you ought to walk a mile in my shoes. Why don't you come on out with me tomorrow night? I looked at the cop, and he said, sure, why not?
What were the rules you had to follow when you were traveling or hanging out with dealers?
There were no rules. It wasn't like, now I'm going to take you to a place, you know, don't look anybody in the eye. It was none of that stuff. I was with, the baddest guy in town. So where does a 500-pound gorilla sit anywhere he wants? I'm with him. I'm with Gorgo over here. So, don't lose sight of him. Don't let him wander off and, leave you alone. I mean, I wouldn't be in that place for a nanosecond without a guy like that.
How would he explain you to other people?
Just say, I'm this writer. I got this writer coming around and, they look at him and, everybody got used to seeing me because I was, sometimes I would be like the only white guy around. And, if they see a white guy walking around in circles like that who's not obviously a customer, the second thought is that the guy's a cop. So this guy Rodney, the Rodney character, basically had to constantly calm people down and explain to them that, I'm not there. My presence is not a danger to them, and I should be allowed to live.
Richard Price is my guest. His new novel is called Clockers, and it's about dealers and cops. And he's also a screenwriter in addition to a novelist, and his movies include Sea of Love, the Martin Scorsese episode of New York Stories, and The Color of Money. I'm going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Screenwriter and novelist Richard Price is my guest. Now, you hung out with cops a lot as part of your research, too.
Right.
And I'm wondering if the cops, knowing that you were also hanging out with dealers, ever tried to get information from you.
Oh, well, the funny thing is that I hung out with everybody so much, people kind of forgot that I was a writer, and they started telling me more than they were telling the guy that sent me to him in the first place. I mean, they were, you know, occupationally adversaries. So he would say, you know, to the cop who sent me over, hey, man, don't tell him this, but, you know, he thinks I'm over here, but I'm really over there. You know, and then I'd run with the cop, and he'd say, well, you know, don't tell Rodney this, but, you know, he thinks I'm over here, but I'm really over there. So in a way, I knew more than, I mean, I was like the girlfriend between this married couple, and it was kind of like a marriage between these cops and these dope dealers, because, as I said, they needed each other. Every once in a while, somebody would pull a real number on me. Like, I was, you know, my standard fee was like $100 for a sit-down. If you sit down and answer my questions for $3, I'll buy you some drinks and I'll buy you a steak, and you get $100 change. And I sat down with this narcotics cop, and I, you know, he talked for about 2 hours, and I gave him $100, and he took the money, but he didn't say thank you, and he gave me kind of like a dirty look, which I couldn't figure out. You know, I was a little paranoid. And the next night, I went out with one of the drug dealers, and I spent, you know, a number of hours with him, at the end of which he got his pay, and he started laughing. And I said, what's so funny? He says, yeah. He says, you gave Frank $100 last night, didn't you? He says, yeah, last time I had a meet with Frank, I told him you were paying me $500. You know? So, you know, things like that would happen. But that's what I mean. There was like an intimacy there that, you know, that at its base is potentially deadly and deceptively relaxed. But it's not, you know, you there, drop that gun. I mean, it's real flexible out there. There's not too many oak trees. There's lots of willows.
Did you get the impression that the cops respected the dealers and the dealers respected the cops on some level?
No, it's respect is a funny word. Understood is a better word. I mean, mm-hmm. People understood why people did the way that it's really, in, you know, unless you're brain dead, if you're a cop and you're out there a certain number of years, you have to have some getting of wisdom about why people are the way they are and how people act in certain situations. I don't think there's a cop in the world who doesn't deep down inside understand how a kid can at 15 or 16 turn into a drug dealer given what he's seen before that kid had been born in that neighborhood, you know. And there's probably the more reflective cops always wind up saying, there but for the grace of God go I. If I had been born in this project, I don't know, I probably wouldn't be a cop. I'd probably be like him.
One of your cops in the novel says he's done so many strip searches over the years that there's one guy's underwear who he is more familiar with than his own. What's the etiquette for you when you're standing by watching a strip search?
I don't help. I mean, I just stand there back discreetly, and the kids were going crazy because they couldn't figure out who I was. This sixth white guy in this car that used to come down and make their lives miserable at any time of night or day. And they knew those five guys. They christened them. They gave them their street names. And so when there's a sixth guy that they don't know, they get all hinky because they say, who the hell is this guy? Is this a new guy we have to worry about? Well, he doesn't look like a cop. You know, he's kind of skinny. He looks a little scared. He doesn't have a gun. Do you think maybe he's a special cop? Or maybe he's a commissioner? Or maybe, he's a lawyer? But they were going crazy trying to figure out who I was. And I don't want to make eye contact with anybody because then they're going to see, you know how much I'm really holding it in. And until I finally heard one guy say really out loud, that guy ain't no cop, man. Look how scared he is. Of course, which you completely fall apart when they say that. But
cops and dealers tend to have their own language. And I wonder if that's one of the things that interests you as a writer.
Oh sure, you know I've always been into you know the way the urban patois, you know of any group. What I decided to do is that some of these kids were it sounded like Lord Buckley to me, or somebody you have to listen 10 times before you understand what they're saying, but by and large I decided to forego doing the Margaret Mead number and getting the glossary right, because I figured even if I nailed it, you know, by the time it hits the book it's old news. You know, so I just decided to concentrate on good dialogue, which is to say dialogue which, because of the progression of the words, captures the way that individual metabolizes his thoughts.
Is clockers a word you made up yourself?
No, clockers is a word I heard from a kid in the Bronx and I heard from another kid in Jersey City, but I didn't hear it that often. It basically means the kids get addicted to selling as much as other people get addicted to smoking it. I mean, the transaction of bottles for cash, it's an addicting ritual. And I had kids tell me about how they developed constipation problems because they got so hung up on the money they were making down there, they were holding it in. They didn't want to go upstairs and sit on the toilet and miss all that money. It was an addiction, and they were clocking, which is to say they were there around the clock.
Hmm. I think the first novel that you wrote was The Wanderers. That was your first, right?
Right.
And that was about gangs in the Bronx, in the neighborhood that you grew up. Do you think there's a connection between your interest in writing about gangs when you were younger and writing now about people who are on the streets selling drugs?
Well, yeah, because I feel like the only... wherever you are in life, you're always only from one place. And for me, that's the Housing Project's working-class background in the Bronx. And the projects have changed so dramatically, other than, you know, the bricks are the same, but that's about it, that in a way I felt like I was going home and starting all over again as a writer after this eight-year hiatus as a screenwriter. And I'm trying to find myself again as a writer, and it's almost like going home. But, you know, home has changed. It's like Rip Van Winkle.
Well, have you literally gone home back to the housing project you grew up in? And
yeah,
so,
I've been around there. And no, actually, that's. I mean, yeah, I mean, ethnically, it's changed. It's no longer as racially mixed as it was. You know, but you know, I think it's still a pretty good project. I mean, it looks well kept, and you know, I know the cops from that precinct, and you know, and I know that that's one of the more benign precincts in the city.
I know you spent some time teaching at Daytop, which is a drug rehabilitation center.
Right.
You were teaching writing, reading?
Well, I was volunteer teaching creative writing. I was, you know, I had my own drug problem in the early 80s, and sort of when I cleaned myself up, I decided that I should take it a step further, and I went to Daytop to, you know, just talk to the kids that were trying to deal with drugs that was so much more potent and pernicious than the stuff that I fell down on at a such more vulnerable age and with such more hideous backgrounds than I had. I just sort of felt like, let me go in here and tell them, listen, I have it a lot easier than you in this world, you know, and I couldn't handle, you know, three-cut party coke, and you guys are doing kryptonite, you know. I couldn't handle it. You know, and I'm here to tell you that. And then, you know, from there, I just say, you know, it's sort of like going into an AA meeting and saying, hi, you know, my name is Bob, I'm an alcoholic, you know. I mean, it's like I'm, you know, I was in no better shape than any of them. And then, you know, from there, we'd go on and do writing exercises, try to get them to do some experiential writing and express themselves.
Did you like that? Did you like teaching there?
Yeah, I did, because it's not the usual. The thing is, I actually probably enjoy teaching adults and, you know, people in circumstances, educational circumstances like that, much better than I do teaching in a regular, American university, because it's so much more of a struggle for that kid or for that adult to be present in that classroom. It's much more of a conscious choice. It's not that, well, I'm 19 now and I'm supposed to be here, so I'm here. I mean, there's a hunger present in the classroom that I find, you know, much more electrifying.
I think you're probably in the process now of turning your novel Clockers into a screenplay, or has that
right.
been done already?
Well, I'm taking a shot at it.
So you're still working on it?
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. You know, it's the never-ending story.
So where do you start? You wrote the novel first. Now you're turning it into a screenplay.
What you do, the first thing you do with a book when you make it into a script is throw it out the window. It's what I did on Color of Money. Unfortunately, the book is mine, and I know every line by heart.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're supposed to obviously kill your darlings, but I thought I killed all my darlings, and I still have a 300-page script. It's like Lonesome Dove. so I have a lot of work to do and a lot of rethinking. It's very hard. I mean, what a screenwriter does is reinvent a novel for a different art form. He really doesn't know anything to the novel except to capture the spirit of what the book was about. And what you have to do is you have to take 100 pages of deathless prose and just dump it and think about two or three scenes in 10 pages that will, you know, visually and for that medium in shorthand tell you what those 100 pages he threw out the window told you. And it's very tough to reinvent your own book when you've got it so deeply entrenched in you. I've never done this before. I feel like a cannibal eating his own foot.
Do you think you're making a mistake in trying to do it yourself?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, it's my mistake to make. I mean, there's nothing. Listen, whoever's going to do this book is going to screw it up, and they're going to get paid for it. I'd rather screw up my own book, thank you. I mean, it's, I'd rather, you know, I'm saying this, you know, semi-facetiously. I mean, obviously, I hope to, you know, to make this work. But, I mean, it's the most frustrating thing in the world is that you write a book and you feel proud of it and it has a certain vision. And then when they make a movie out of it, some guy just goes in there hacking away merrily in his butcher's apron. And you go nuts when you see the finished product on the screen. If this thing doesn't work, I'd much rather be the one that's responsible for its failure than some other screenwriter, because it's the lesser of two pains.
This is the first novel of yours that doesn't come out of your life. All the others were in some way autobiographical.
Right.
Was it movies that got you out of yourself in terms of the subject of your writing?
Well, what happened is that, you know, like with the breaks, I kind of felt bankrupt as an autobiographical writer. I started to feel like I went to the well too many times. And I decided that a solution out of that would be I had all these offers to do screenplays. And I decided, well, you tell me a story and I'll write it. I can't come up with any great epiphanic structures right now. I'm a pen for hire. Whose body do you want me to inhabit? You want me to be a pool hustler? Okay, no problem. You want to be a cop? Okay, I'll be an abstract artist. I'll be, you know, like the Headless Horseman. You know, you just keep them checks coming. And, you know, I'll just sort of refresh myself. I always knew it. I would be coming back to writing novels. You know, I do believe that sometimes there are second acts in American lives. And I did. It took a lot longer than I thought it would take for me to get back to novels because... unlike cocaine, screenwriting is impossible to give up. And when you get good at it, you know, the seduction is potent. It's, you know, constantly, well, you can work with this big star that you never worked with before and get this big check. You've never seen numbers like this before. And you're constantly, it's like they're throwing all this candy at you and you want to say, no, I'm going to go home and eat, you know, my whole wheat toast, you know, I'm going to do my novel because it's good for me and I've got to grow as a person. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that you do. And at some point, I just had enough.
How does it feel to have written a novel again?
It feels great. I mean, I've never been so proud of anything I've ever written.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
No, you're welcome.
Richard Price, his new novel is Clockers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.